She did not slam the door. She did not cry. She set the ring down beside his coffee cup, and the small click it made against the saucer was the loudest sound the Duke of Aldermore would hear for the rest of his life. Sebastian Hale did not look up at once. He was reading a letter he had already read twice, holding it as a shield, and he had grown so accustomed to her enduring his silences that he assumed this was another one. So he let the quiet stretch, the way a man tests a frozen pond with his weight, certain it will hold. Then he saw the ring on the saucer, the Aldermore betrothal ring, his mother's, 3 centuries of duchesses in a single old garnet, lying beside his coffee as though she had returned a borrowed book. "Eleanor, I have left the household accounts in order on your study desk," she said, already at the door, drawing on her gloves. Her voice was perfectly level, and that levelness was a thing he would hear in his sleep for weeks. "Mrs., Frewin knows where everything is. You needn't trouble yourself." He noticed, against his will, against every intention, with the particular helplessness of a man noticing the wrong thing at the worst moment, that her hands did not shake as she fitted the gloves over them. He noticed the faint stain of ink along the side of her right forefinger, the mark she always carried and he had always privately disdained, the banker's daughter who could not keep her hands clean of figures. He had sneered at that ink for 3 months. Now he could not stop looking at it. "Sit down," he said. "Whatever this is, we will discuss it like sensible people." "We have never once discussed anything, Your Grace." She did not raise her voice. She did not turn the knife. She simply set it down, the way she had set down the ring. "You issued, and I endured. I am told that is what your sort of marriage is. I find I have no further appetite for it." And she went. The door closed with a soft final competence, and the Duke of Aldermore was left sitting alone at a long table with a cooling cup of coffee and a garnet ring that suddenly weighed more than the house. He did not go after her. This is the part that mattered, the hinge the whole day would turn on, and he did not go after her, because he was certain as he had been of anything since his father's debts had come down on him like a roof, that she would be back by evening. Where would she go? She was a merchant's daughter who had bought herself a coronet with her father's money. A woman did not walk away from a duchess's life. She would discover within the hour how cold the world was to a girl with new money and no title to wrap it in, and she would come back chastened, and he would be magnanimous, and everything would resume. He turned the ring over in his fingers and went to find his coat. There were creditors to soothe. There were always creditors to soothe. It had not always been like this, and that was the part he would have to live with. 3 weeks before, at the Carstairs dinner, he had watched her come in late and a little breathless, color high, and had felt the old suspicion stir, that she enjoyed being the duchess-to-be, that she had dressed for the part. He had not known then that she had spent that very afternoon in a counting house off Lombard Street, buying back the Holloway debt with her own money so the Duns would not serve him notice at his own table, and that the color in her face was not vanity, but the flush of a woman who has just, in secret, saved a man and cannot tell him so. He had been seated beside Lord Pelham, who had a loud voice and a vulgar curiosity. And Pelham had said, behind his hand but not behind it enough, marrying the bank, then, Aldermore, can't blame a man, needs must, and Sebastian, stung, proud, wanting above all not to be pitied, had said the unforgivable thing lightly, as though it cost him nothing. One makes the necessary investments. He had not known she stood behind him. He had turned and seen her face, and known, in one cold drop of the stomach, that she had heard every word. She had not wept. He ought to have learned, that night, that she never would. She had only looked at him a long moment, then taken the chair across the table and made conversation with the woman at her left so warmly that half the table fell a little in love with her, and not once for the rest of the evening did she look at him again. Later, in the dark of the carriage, He had felt obscurely that he should say something, and had managed only, "You are very quiet." "You called me an investment, Your Grace." Her voice had no heat in it at all. "I am told one does not converse with one's investments. One merely expects them to perform." A pause, and then the single time she let him see the edge of the thing underneath. "I had hoped you were marrying a person. But I shall adjust my expectations to the asset you appear to have bought. I am told I yield well." He had told himself she was being dramatic. He had told himself a great many things that were easier than the truth, which was that a woman who saves a man in secret and is named an investment to his face will, sooner or later, on a perfectly ordinary morning, set a ring down beside a coffee cup and decline to perform any longer. The first crack in his certainty came at noon, and it came from his man of business. Mr. Pine had served the Aldermore estate for 30 years, and he arrived at the townhouse grey-faced and out of breath, which Sebastian had never once seen. "Your Grace," he said, before he had got his hat off, "the Selby note." "The 8,000. It has been settled." "Settled," Sebastian set down his pen. "By whom?" "I have not settled it. I cannot settle it. That is rather the defining feature of the Selby note, Pine, that is what I came to discover. And the Holloway debt as well, the one we have been holding off since Michaelmas, paid in full, quietly, 3 weeks ago, through Marsh and Company." Pine's hands worked at the brim of his hat. "Your Grace, someone has been buying your debts. For 2 months, through the late Mr. Marsh's bank, note by note. Whoever it is now holds more of your name in paper than you do." A cold thing turned over in Sebastian's stomach, and he told himself it was alarm, because he was not yet ready to know what it actually was. "My cousin," he said slowly, "Crispin manages a great deal of business I do not see. Mr. Crispin Hale has been to this house 6 times this month, asking after exactly these notes," Pine said. "He did not buy them. He wished very much to know who had." By 2 o'clock the Duke had begun, for the first time, to be afraid in a direction he could not name. The trouble was that the more he looked, the more of his life he found had been quietly held up by hands he had not bothered to see. The merchants who should have cut off his credit a year ago and had not. The mortgage on the Aldermore Dower House that should have foreclosed at Lady Day and had been, the agent told him, extended at the request of an interested party. The school fees of his late steward's 3 children, paid anonymously since the man's death, which Sebastian had assumed some charity had covered, and which he now understood no charity had. Every place his ruin should have shown a crack, something had been quietly mortared into the gap. He had walked across that floor for a year believing it was sound. He had not once asked who was underneath it, holding it up. He found her father's ledgers, copies, in a clean hand he knew, in the bottom drawer of the desk in the morning room she used, the room he never entered. Page after page in Eleanor's writing, his debts, listed, ranked, dated, with annotations in the margin in a shorthand of pounds and percentages he could not fully read, but could read enough of. "Call this one first. C. Exposed here. Do not let S. Learn until the bond is found. C. Crispin and the bond," underlined 3 times. He was still standing there, holding the ledger, when his cousin was announced. Crispin Hale came in smiling, which he did beautifully, the way some men are born able to ride. He was a year younger than the Duke, and had spent that year, and every year since, being the charming one, the easy one. The cousin everyone agreed it was such a pity had not been born first. "Sebastian, I came the moment I heard. The whole of Mayfair is saying your banker's girl has bolted. You must be devastated." He poured himself brandy without asking. "Of course, between us, it may be a mercy. One does not like to say it, but a man cannot unmarry money once it's spent, and there were always going to be questions about the settlements, Why have you been to this house 6 times asking after my debts? Crispin's smile did not move, but something behind it did. The way still water moves when something turns over beneath it, I look after the family interest. As the heir, you are the heir, Sebastian said, only so long as I am ruined and childless. I have spent 3 years being too proud and too tired to wonder why my affairs grew worse precisely as fast as you grew kinder. I am wondering now. He held up the ledger. What is the bond, Crispin? And there it was. For one bare instant, before the charm came back down like a curtain, a flicker of pure calculation, the face beneath the face. I haven't the faintest idea what you mean, Crispin said pleasantly, and set down his glass, and left, and the speed with which he left told Sebastian more than an hour of answers would have. He understood then 2 things at once, and they arrived together so that he could never afterward separate them. The first was that his cousin had been engineering his destruction for years. The second was that the woman he had treated as a purchase had spent 2 months, in silence, with her own fortune and her own dead father's hands, standing between him and that destruction. And that this morning, with perfect calm, she had stopped. He sent for his coat again. This time he went after her. She was not at the bank, though they knew her there, knew her well, the clerk straightening at the sound of her name, Miss Marsh. Yes, Your Grace. But she is not here, and the way they said it, with a respect he had never once heard offered to himself, was its own small humiliation. She was not at her father's house in Bloomsbury, shut and under Holland covers. It was past 5, the spring light going long and gold across the streets, before a note found him at his club, in a hand he knew, brought by a boy who would not say who had paid him. If you wish to understand what you threw away, it read, come to the Hartley's rout tonight. Crispin will be there, and so will the bond. Come as a guest, not as a duke. For once in your life, watch instead of command. E.M. He read it 4 times. Then he went home and dressed, and for the first time in 3 years, he did not look at himself in the glass and see a coronet. He saw a man who had been handed something good and had spent 3 months proving he did not deserve it, and who had perhaps until midnight to become someone who did. The Hartley's rout was a crush, 400 candles and 300 people, and the Duke of Aldermore came into it, as he had been told to, as a guest, and found that no one was looking at him at all. They were looking at the far end of the long drawing room, where Eleanor Marsh stood in grey silk, the colour of a coming storm, entirely surrounded. He had never seen her like this. He had only ever seen her in his house, in his silences, made small to fit the space he allowed her. Here she was, there was no other word for it, sovereign. The merchants and the bankers and the men of business who actually moved the money of the kingdom, the men a duke pretended not to need, had arranged themselves around her the way iron arranges itself around a magnet, and she stood in the center of them with a glass she was not drinking, and spoke quietly, and they leaned in to hear. He understood, watching, that he had been given a great fortune and had married only the smallest, dullest part of it. The rest of it was this. The rest of it was her. He did not go to her. He had been told to watch, and he was, perhaps for the first time, trying to do as he was told. So he was watching when Crispin made his move. His cousin had brought a man with him, a heavy, prosperous man in a 2 new coat, whom Sebastian did not know, but whom half the room clearly did. By the way, a small cold space opened around him. That is Krill, murmured a voice at Sebastian's shoulder, Pine, who had not been invited, and had come anyway, twisting his hat. The moneylender, Your Grace. The worst of them. If Krail holds your paper, you are not ruined. You are owned. Crispin guided Krail through the crush with the ease of a man springing a trap he has baited for a long time, and brought him to rest, deliberately, within earshot of every gossip in the room, and raised his voice exactly enough. A bond under the late Duke's own hand, he was saying, sorrowful, loud, £25,000. And poor Sebastian cannot pay a farthing of it. It will all come out within the week, I'm afraid. The title's an empty box. The new Duchess saw it, sensible girl, and got out before the crash, though one does wonder where a banker's daughter learned to read a sinking ship so well. He let the laughter start. I take no pleasure in it. But the family must be protected, and if my cousin cannot, then the duty falls, as these things do to me. It was beautifully done. In 1 minute he had ruined the Duke, branded the Duchess a coward and a schemer, and dressed his own theft of a dukedom as reluctant duty, in front of the only audience in England whose opinion could make all three true. Sebastian started forward. Every instinct of 32 years as a duke rose up to command, to deny, to crush, and a hand closed on his arm. Pine, she wrote to me too, Your Grace, the old man said quietly. She said, Whatever he does, do not let him save me. He has spent 3 years saving his pride. Tonight he must learn to watch me save him. His grip tightened. Let her work. So the Duke of Aldermore, who had never let anyone fight a battle he could reach, stood still and let her. Eleanor set down her untasted glass. She did not hurry. She crossed the room into the silence Crispin had made, and the merchants and bankers turned with her, a tide following the moon, so that by the time she reached the two men she did not arrive alone. She arrived at the head of the only people in the room who understood what was about to happen. Mr. Crail, she said. How fortunate. I have been meaning to return your property. Crail's prosperous face went carefully blank. Madam, I don't believe we are acquainted. We are not. But your business and I are old friends. The bond you are carrying tonight, the late Duke's hand. £25,000. You bought it 8 months ago from a broker named Finch for a little under £4,000, did you not? Knowing the signature was worth a fortune, and certain no one would ever dare examine the hand of a dead duke. She did not raise her voice, and the room had gone so quiet that she did not need to. I dared. I bought every other note Finch ever brokered. I have 11 of them, Mr. Crowell. And in every single one the late Duke's signature is identical, exactly, mechanically identical, down to the slip of the pen on the H. Because not one of them was signed by the late Duke. They were traced. By the same hand, the hand of a man who has been forging his own family for 3 years to inherit what he could not earn. She turned then, for the first time, to Crispin. And the Duke watched his cousin understand that the trap had never been his. You did not engineer my husband's ruin, Mr. Hale, Eleanor said. You authored it, in ink, in a hand my father's clerks matched to your own letters a month ago. I have the originals with three magistrates this evening, that is where I was at 5 o'clock, while half of London amused itself wondering which shop I had fled to. The bond Mr. Crail meant to ruin a duke with tonight is the evidence that hangs you. You brought the rope into the room yourself, and you handed it to a moneylender, and you raised your voice so that everyone would be watching when it was pulled. The silence held for one heartbeat longer. Then it broke, not into uproar, but into the low, terrible murmur of 300 people rearranging, in an instant, everything they had believed 5 minutes before. Crail was already stepping back from Crispin as from a plague. Crispin's beautiful smile was still on his face, but it had nothing behind it now, and a smile with nothing behind it is the most frightened thing in the world. You cannot prove a man's hand, he said. I can prove it 11 times, said Eleanor Marsh, and the magistrates agree. Run if you like. Marsh and Company has a man at every coaching inn on the North Road. I bought those too. It was the most magnificent thing Sebastian had ever seen. And he had done nothing to deserve standing in the same room as it. He found her afterward in the cool of the Hartley's conservatory, among the orange trees, where she had gone to be away from the noise of her own victory. She did not turn when he came in. The bond, the forged bond, the thing that had nearly ended him, lay folded on the bench beside her, and she was looking at it the way you look at a snake you have killed. "You should not have done it alone," he said, and heard how wrong it was even as it left him. "I did not do it alone. I did it without you. They are not the same thing." She still did not turn. "I had my father's clerks, and his name, and his network, and the only inheritance that ever mattered, which was that he taught his daughter to read a ledger as well as any son. I had everything I needed. The only thing I lacked, Your Grace, was a husband who thought I might be good for anything but the £40,000 he spent before the ink was dry. Eleanor, you called me an investment." Now she turned, and her composure was worse than weeping, because it was total. To Lord Pelham's face, "The afternoon I had spent buying back the Holloway debt, so you would not be served notice at your own table. I understood then that I could save your house 100 times over, and you would only ever see the price tied to my wrist." She drew a breath. "So this morning I stopped saving you, to see whether you would even notice you were falling. You noticed by noon. It took the threat of ruin for you to see me at all. Do you understand why that is not enough?" He understood. That was the unbearable part. He understood completely. He stood among the orange trees and felt 3 years of cold pride drain out of him and leave nothing behind it but a man who had been loved, competently and in secret, by someone he had been too frightened of being unworthy to love back. "My father left me £60,000 in debt and a single lesson," he said. "That everyone who ever came close to me wanted the coronet and not the man. And that the surest way never to be robbed of your heart is never to admit you have one. I have run my whole life on it. When your father's settlement saved my estate, I could not bear it. That I had been bought, that I was the thing being purchased, that the merchant's daughter held the deed to me. So I made you small, because a small woman could not have rescued me, and if you had not rescued me then, I was not a man who needed rescuing." His voice was not steady. He let it not be steady. "I made you endure my shame so that I would not have to feel it. It is the worst thing I have ever done, and I did it slowly, over breakfast tables, which is the only way a coward can do a great cruelty." Something moved in her face. He took one step and stopped, because he had not earned the rest of them. And the moment hung there, the orange leaves shivering. The distance between them a thing that might have closed, until a footman appeared in the doorway with a message that Mr. Crispin Hale had been taken up by the magistrates at the North Turnpike, and the spell broke, and Eleanor looked away, and the thing that had almost happened did not. "You should go and see your house secured," she said. "That is what dukes do." She picked up the forged bond and held it out to him, this proof that she had saved him, this thing he had not asked for and did not deserve. "Take it. It is yours now." It always was. He did not take the bond. He had done as he was told all day. He had watched. He had not commanded. He had let her save him. He had one thing left that was his to do, and he understood, at last, that it was not to act, but to refuse the easy ending. "No," he said. She blinked. It was the first time all day he had surprised her. "I will not take it from your hand like a man collecting what he is owed," he said. "You have spent 2 months letting me believe I stood on solid ground, and you were the ground, and I never once looked down. I am done being saved in secret. Tomorrow I am going to stand up in front of the same people who watched you do this tonight, and I am going to tell them that my cousin nearly destroyed this house, and that a banker's daughter saved it by name in the light, and let them make of it what they will. Let them say the Duke of Aldermore married a woman cleverer and braver than himself. It is the only true thing that has been said about my marriage since it began." The bond trembled, very slightly, in her outstretched hand. "Stop," she said, and her voice had lost its terrible levelness at last. "Stop making me a speech. I have heard a great many beautiful things said by men who wanted something. Tell me what you intend to do. Court you, he said, properly, from the beginning. As though you were not already my wife and the saving of me, but a woman I had only just been fortunate enough to be introduced to, and had no claim on whatsoever, and would have to earn. He reached out, not for the bond, but past it, and closed his cold hand over her ink-stained one, the hand he had disdained for 3 months, the hand that had held up his entire life. I threw you away this morning over a coffee cup, because I was too proud to be rescued. By nightfall I had learned what you are. I am not going to spend tomorrow pretending I have not. Eleanor, I do not want the £40,000. I never knew, until you set that ring down, that I had stopped being able to see anything but. I want the woman with ink on her hands who reads me better than my own man of business. Stay, and let me earn that. Or go, and I will spend the rest of my life knowing exactly what I threw away, which is no less than I deserve. He thought for one foolish moment that he had said enough. Then the conservatory door opened, and the noise of the ballroom came in with it, and the noise had changed. He heard his own name in it, and hers, and beneath the music, the particular purr of the tongue handing down a verdict. The footman who had brought word of Crispin lingered, white-faced, and gave him the rest when Sebastian beckoned, that it was already racing through the rooms that the Duke of Aldermore's cousin was a forger, and his duchess a tradesman's daughter, who had dragged the law into a ballroom to unman the air, that his aunt had called for her carriage rather than be seen to stay, that the wiser counsel, behind every fan in the house. Was that a duke might yet save his name if he put the merchant's girl quietly aside and let the cousin's disgrace bury itself? He watched the cost of it land on Eleanor all at once, that she had won, and that winning had bought her the one thing her fortune never could, a welcome in the world she had married into. She had saved his house and made herself unwelcome in it inside a single hour. She stepped back from him and set the forged bond down on the bench, deliberately, the way she had set down the ring that morning, a thing she was finished carrying. There, she said, very steady, very pale, which was how he knew it was costing her everything. Now you have the proof and the house entire, and you may have your name back as well, the one thing I cannot hand you, because I am the thing standing in front of it. Put me aside. I will go quietly, I do everything quietly. You will be a duke with a saved estate and a tragic, sensible story, and no one will say you married beneath you a day longer than you had to. A breath. I have given you back your house. Let me give you back your name. It is the last thing I have, and then we are quit. It was the easy ending. It was the ending his whole life had trained him to take. No. This time the word did not cost him, it freed him. He kept her ink-stained hand in his, and he did not lower his voice, and he did not care that the door stood open, and half the ton was listening for precisely this. I will not put you aside to save a name that you saved. Let them say what they like. Let my aunt go. Let them call it the ruin of the House of Aldermore, that its duke loved his wife in the open and said so. It is the first thing this house has done in a generation that I am not ashamed of. For a long moment she only looked at him, the banker's daughter who weighed everything, weighing this last and largest sum. I will not wear your mother's ring again until you have earned it, she said at last. But you may begin. It was not a surrender, and that was why it broke the last of him. It was a verdict. Handed down by the only person whose judgment he had come to fear and to want. Not yet. But begin, which from Eleanor Marsh he was learning, was the most extravagant thing she knew how to say. He kissed her hand, the ink-stained one, in the orange-scented dark, and felt 3 years of cold come off him like a thaw. Then he drew her arm through his and walked her back into the ballroom, into the waiting verdict and let the whole of London watch the Duke of Aldermore choose the merchant's daughter over his own good name, openly, gladly, with nothing hidden, which was the first genuinely brave thing he had done in 32 years, and he had learned how to do it, that very day, from her. The Duke of Aldermore kept his word, which was a novelty for him, and became a habit. He stood up the following week, not in a drawing room but in the open court of public opinion, at a dinner he hosted himself, and told 24 of the most powerful people in London that his house had been saved from his own cousin's forgery by his wife, naming her, by her work, in the light, exactly as he had promised. It cost him a great deal of pride, and a little of his standing among the older sort, who felt a duke ought not to admit to being rescued by a woman, and trade money at that. He found he did not care. He found, to his surprise, that a man unburdened of his pride is very much lighter to carry. Crispin Hale was convicted of forgery on the evidence of 11 traced bonds and the testimony of Marsh and Company's clerks. He was not hanged, the family name being what it was, but transported, which in the end is its own slow kind of ending. He went out on a ship in the autumn and was not spoken of again, save once, by Eleanor, who remarked over breakfast some months later that she hoped the colony had good locks. Mr. Crail, finding 11 of his bonds suddenly worthless and his name attached to a forger's trial, retired from the lending of money to the keeping of pigs in Hampshire, which all parties agreed suited him better. It was a year and a season later, on a bright autumn morning, that Eleanor Marsh, Eleanor Hale. Now, the Duchess of Aldermore, though she still signed the bank's papers Marsh, and the bank had never done better, came down to breakfast to find the garnet ring lying once again beside her coffee cup. She looked at it for a long moment. Then she looked at her husband, who was watching her over the rim of his cup with the particular stillness of a man who has waited a long time and is trying very hard not to ruin it by speaking too soon. "It has been," he said carefully, "a year of earning. I am told the terms were not yet, but begin. I should like to inquire whether the account has come into credit." She picked up the ring. It had been resized. It fit. He had noticed somewhere in the long year, the thing he had been too proud to see at the start, that she had once worn it on a ribbon because it was too large and she had not wished to trouble him with the asking. He had had it made to fit her hand, ink and all. "You're improving," she said, which from Eleanor was a coronation, and slid the ring onto her own finger, because she had decided, having weighed it as she weighed everything, that the account was good. Outside, the rents came in honestly, and the dower house stood unmortgaged, and a steward's 3 children were at school under their own names. Inside, a duke who had thrown away the best thing in his life over a coffee cup had spent a year learning to deserve being allowed to keep it. And a woman who had been valued for the wrong £40,000 had finally been seen, entirely, ink and ledger and storm grey steel, by the one person whose seeing she had wanted. "You set the ring down once and walked out," he said, "and I have never been so rightly punished in my life. Promise me you will do it again the moment I forget what you are." "Oh," said the Duchess of Aldermore, reaching for the coffee pot, entirely at home, "you may depend upon it.